Hello.
Good morning. How are you today? So happy to have you. Let's see. I'll turn my sound up a little bit. I hope you had a nice holiday weekend.
You too. I hope.
It was busy. That's a good thing.
Oh.
Well, I appreciate you agreeing to talk to us today about your experiences as a Swarthmore student involved with various civil rights activities. I have spoken to four students, former students, I should say, thus far, and it has been a wonderful, vibrant conversation. We are looking to really understand the connection between the college experience, the Quaker experience, or not, and the student organizational experiences on campus and off that help to engage you in the activity and the kinds of things you did, how you felt about it, how others felt about it, and everything we don't know about your experience thus far. I'm interested in how those experiences helped move people into their current work. Many of you are still doing civil rights work in various ways, though it may not be specifically about a racial group. It's a lot about the environment and about, in your case, education, economics, and all of the ways that the start of your organization and your work helped us to keep thinking about how to make change that really is significant for all people living. So, with that being said, please tell us your full name and the years you were at Swarthmore.
So I'm Alan Jalen, and I was at Swarthmore from the fall of 1962 until I graduated in 66.
So you were across all the really, really active periods. Another question I would like to throw in because it creeps up and I'm becoming increasingly interested in the influence of this, and that is how the Vietnam War kind of I won't say took over, but I will say captured the focus of many people who were previously engaged in civil rights in the southern states, and that logically, reasonably changed to a focus of anti-war. So if you have comments or experiences with that, I absolutely welcome them. And so if we can start to talk about your background before you came to Swarthmore, any experiences you had that really, you might say, in looking back, kind of set you up for the work you did there.
Yeah, so I actually think this interview is going to be less useful for you than maybe some others because I didn't have a big change when I went to Swarthmore. My parents were French communists. My father was, a union organizer for the Communist Party in France before World War II. They were involved in the resistance, in the communist resistance during World War II. And so I grew, I sort of grew up in that tradition. When I was in high school, I got active in the effort to stop nuclear testing and nuclear bomb testing. In those days, they used to test above ground, and people were getting cancer because of fallout. It's kind of crazy. They eventually stopped, but at the time that was a small minority of people working on that. But, you know, that was a natural thing for me to get involved with as a high school activist. So then when I went to Swarthmore, you know, I knew from the start I wanted to get involved in the whatever the left-wing political life was like on campus. So, and I was not a Quaker. And so none of that actually influenced me, nor was it the reason, a reason for me to go to Swarthmore.
Why did you go?
My parents were immigrants. They didn't know a whole lot about the country. I knew nothing about colleges. I applied to Swarthmore because two of my very close friends in the Band the Bomb movement were applying. Neither one of them went.
Oh.
So, and, you know, and I got a very generous General Motors scholarship, or I could never have afforded to go to a private school like that. I was headed for City College, I thought, which is what my sister went to. And City College was a fine school, and that would have been fine. City College in New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find it serendipitous, maybe, that you made your way there and mm-hmm. look at the folks you met. Considering your background, it's really extraordinary to think about it. So can you tell me a little more about what it was like when you got there and you found these kindred spirits, or did you find them, or did they find you?
No, I found them. If I remember right, I mean, I was on the lookout for what there was. So the Swarthmore Political Action Committee was club. Yeah, Swarthmore Political Action Club, because it was a school-sponsored club. You know, it was natural for me. They had been involved in Maryland, Cambridge, Maryland. And I only went to Cambridge one day, but then they got involved in Chester. So I was not a leader in that, you know, as a freshman. Or even as a sophomore, I was very active, but I wasn't at the top. So when I was, I think it was when I was a sophomore, and Carl Whitman was definitely, I saw him in your questions, definitely the leader of the organization. Somehow he got involved in Chester. I don't really know how. Met Stanley Branch. Started, I forget what the name of the organization was. I don't think I ever met Gloria Richardson. I don't remember. It's a long time ago, but I don't think so. So then I got involved in all those demonstrations in Chester.
And do you think it was the strength of the people you were speaking with and their fervor about various locations and issues going on there, or do you think it is the left side of you that really made you jump straight in to what they were doing?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was the second.
Okay,
you might find more interesting people who actually changed. Like fundamentally, I mean, I'm sure I changed, right? I was a kid before I got there. I was a lot more mature when I left, but I didn't fundamentally change direction. I do know people who change direction. Not at Swarthmore, I can't think of. Not sure whether the people I was close to at Swarthmore had changed direction. More than me, though, I think.
You continue to tell me that, oh, I didn't do that much. And, you know, other people are more interesting. And I beg to differ because you are all very interesting because you made this piece of history, given what you were doing and where you were and what you were seeing. So everything you have to say, in my opinion, is very useful and very helpful for us to see this history as we keep moving forward. So talk to me more about some of your visits, either to Chester or Cambridge or anywhere else you may have gone to assist with the movement.
So what I remember in Cambridge, the one time I went to Cambridge was there was a demonstration that involved, of course, Cambridge people and the Swarthmore students who had come in for the day. And we also did some door knocking, because I remember, this is really a long time ago, right? My memory is never, even when I was, I've never had a good memory. So, but I, the what I remember about it was we were encouraging, so it was door knocking in Black neighborhoods. I remember that we were encouraging people to register as Democrats. Mm-hmm. They wanted to register as Republicans if they were going to register at all, because of the Civil War. Because the Democrats were all Dixiecrats. And we were encouraging them to register as Democrats because that was the only way to have any influence. The Democratic Party was so dominant. So
wonderful.
That changed later on. Actually, I don't know if it's changed in Maryland so much, but in the rest of the South, it certainly did. I don't know. I also don't know what the strategy was in other parts of the South, whether they are also, because I was never involved in any of that, whether they are also were trying to get people to not register as Republicans, but to register as Democrats, and they wanted to register as Republicans because it was the party of Lincoln in those days. Now it's the party of Trump.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. What were some of the reactions you received when you got the door opened and began talking to people?
You know, I think it was friendly, but I don't have any specific memories of how people reacted. And I don't know that we were very confident that we had accomplished anything. Like, did we get anybody to register? I don't know. I was only there for the day. There was an organization over there, right? We were just sort of day laborers for that. So I don't know anything about, you know, what kind of follow-up they did, or even, you know, the strength of their campaign.
Okay, well, obviously we know that you were successful. Collectively, you all were successful. You helped move the needle.
So in Chester, though, I was much more involved. And I remember that, so there was this organization that Stanley Branch was leading. Mm-hmm. With a lot of help from the Swarthmore kids, or at least help at a certain level. Like, I remember we put together a list of, I think it was 36 demands for this organization at a Swarthmore student's off campus apartment. I mean, that was ridiculous. I think that the feeling of it obviously came from the community, because most of the people at all these demonstrations, the Swarthmore kids were a small minority there. You know, there were hundreds and hundreds of people from Chester. But for writing this manifesto, it certainly did not come out of, you know, there was no like town meeting in Chester where it would happen. But there were people at that meeting who had real ties to Chester, who had talked with people in Chester, and they were really writing out what they had heard, I think. So it wasn't quite as, I don't know that it was manipulative in the sense that I don't think we ever got anybody to, or tried to get anybody to do things that they didn't want to do, you know. But we were also so ignorant of, I didn't know anything about life in Chester. But at any rate, as part of that, so I remember at one point, my roommate and I, Dan Pope, is he on your list?
He is, and we have interviewed.
You have already?
I think he is one of the first to engage in this project, and is his content is already on the Swarthmore website, so yes.
Okay, he's a wonderful guy. he and I were leafleting on the street in Chester, and we got arrested because we didn't have a permit. So apparently they had a local ordinance saying you can't leaflet without a permit. So I think we were held for a few hours and released that time. And eventually we discovered that someone had figured out that you can't actually have a law that says you can't leaflet without a permit. Mm-hmm. That even Chester, Pennsylvania was subject to the First Amendment. So that was the end of that one. And then later on at one point, there were demonstrations outside the home of the local Democratic Party boss. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure Dan was arrested that time too, and so was I. We were arrested for essentially causing a disturbance. It was unlawful assembly and a fray. So that, so our version of the Freedom Movement song was "We Have Not Afraid" instead of "We Are Not Afraid." And they held us for, I think, 8 days, something like that, at a giant, what was it? It was like a warehouse kind of place, you know, with garage doors. The cops were not unfriendly. Like nobody got beaten up or anything like that, that I can remember. We had conversations with them, but eventually we got bailed out. And that also was, I don't know, eventually quashed. Did we go to trial? Can't remember. I can't remember whether we, I'm sure there wasn't a trial. What I'm trying to remember actually is, yeah, I'm pretty sure there was no trial. We must have been arraigned. That must have happened, but I don't remember it. But in between, there was a housing project, I remember. And so there were Swarthmore students who were sort of assigned to community leaders, you know, to help them. And I was assigned to a guy in this housing project. And in addition to being a community leader, pretty sure he was also a marijuana dealer. And I remember going around with him and, you know, to talk to people. And I wasn't doing much. He was doing the talking, of course. And along the way, he was also making drug deals. Hang on one sec. I've got somebody that can be
right back. Sure.
This was a long, I was involved for, I mean, that's as a sophomore, I was involved for a long time. And I'm only remembering these little incidents, you know, I think there was a whole lot more to it. I certainly went to many meetings in Chester. I didn't play a leadership role in that though. And then, go ahead if you want to follow up and then I'll tell you.
Well, I was wondering whether Stanley Branch was with the NAACP and what more you might be able to tell me about him, if anything.
Yeah, I don't remember a lot about it. Just because I don't want to try to.
It's okay.
Something that's not there. I do remember at one point. So, you know, it's these little blips. He organized or helped to organize a meeting of many civil rights people. Mm-hmm. That is civil rights leaders. Must have been maybe 30 people from around the country who came, and they formed some kind of coordinating organization that I don't think ever, you know, really survived. But the thing that I remember most clearly from that meeting was Malcolm X came to that meeting. And, you know, we Swarthmore students were probably, I don't know, 10 of us or something like that, went to the meeting, and I was sitting behind Malcolm X. And what I remember most clearly about that was that his hands were completely still. Like I always, you know, little nervous movements. Not him, completely still. And I remember what he said to them, you know, when he got up to speak. He said, you know, I might be too far from the mainstream for you guys to actually want to work with, but I can help you because I make you appear to be moderates. That's all I remember. I'm sure there was a lot more to it.
But that's an amazing statement because, you know, we don't hear statements like that very frequently when going through the happenings. So I'm thrilled to have you say that. And what else can you remember? What do you remember? Any specific engagements with, say, Tom Hayden or Paul Goodman or Staunton Boyd and whatever else you would like to tell us about, Carl, would be great.
Well, Tom, I only saw at a national convention. I don't think I ever said a word to Tom Hayden until trying to remember when this happened, but at one point I was at the SDS Newark project and he was leading it, but I was only there, like I wasn't living there. You know, I lived in Queens and I would, you know, was commuting there for, I don't know, maybe a few weeks. I didn't do much, a whole lot there either. I was trying to help them set up a community radio system based on some long obsolete technology and which never worked, but was supposed to make it possible for you to have low power radio stations, sort of neighborhood radio stations. It never happened. So that was a bit later, and it was, you know, part of the ERAP project. You've heard of that, I assume?
The
ERAP, we called it, it was the
ERAP, yes.
Economic Research and Action Project of SDS. Mm-hmm. Right. So let's see. And then, you know, I don't know exactly when did that happen? Was it at the end of my sophomore year, possibly? There was the Black Power movement, sort of took SNCC by storm.
Yes.
And oh, I'll tell you another story though before that, which is weird. So I went to the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember that pretty clearly. And I remember John Lewis, right, the chairman of SNCC, saying these approximate words: "We will march through the South, yay, as Sherman did, or like Sherman did." And I remember, like, I remember where in the along the reflecting pool I was, and all that, with my sister and her boyfriend, who we had driven down from New York. And I remember thinking, I don't know if that's such a wise move to say that we're going to act like Sherman, right? Who just demolished whole sections of the South in order to win the war. But John Lewis never said that. I later heard a recording of his speech. He did not say that, but it had been in an earlier draft. Mm. So I'm conflating, I must have, you know, because SNCC and SPAC had, you know, pretty, there was a lot of exchange. I remember at some point people from SNCC coming to a meeting. I don't even remember what was discussed. I must have seen it somehow and then imagined it. You know, memory plays tricks on you. Like I remember talking to a guy who was a memory, now you don't want to hear the story. That's going to get us far apart. But memories are often, sometimes, you know, you feel like you totally remember something and you didn't. And I think first I thought, oh, this recording was, you know, edited, but I don't think so. I think he never said that.
We'll never know. But the important part is the memory itself. That's why we capture oral history, because it is memory. It is okay. Not fact.
Well, it okay, that's true.
What you saw while you were there, and it's valid.
So then with Black Power, we were kind of pushed out of, I mean, I think we were being pretty arrogant, thinking that we knew what people ought to be doing in the Black community in Chester, when we actually knew nothing about them, right? And but the Black Power movement sort of pushed us out of civil rights, pretty much. And at that time, the war in Vietnam was picking up, right? And so just by coincidence, right? They had nothing to do with each other. I don't think Black Power was influenced by American troops going to Vietnam. But that sort of, because we sort of no longer felt so comfortable. I mean, that didn't happen overnight, right? Because I also remember when I was in graduate school, have you ever seen the SNCC button that had a white hand and a black hand clasped?
Yes.
Right? And I had one of those buttons and I loved it. And I called the SNCC office to find out whether they were still using that button because of Black Power. Did they still want to use that as their symbol, right? And they said, well, some people are inking in the white hand so that it's two black hands. So then I stopped using that button. So, but that must have happened in grad school. So what, right? Because I'm pretty sure that I was living in Cambridge at the time. So that makes me, that sort of reflects that this was a period of years that, right, that change. Anyway, meanwhile, so then in the anti-war movement, right after the United States started bombing North Vietnam, that happened to be a week when a lot of other sort of leadership people in SPAC were really busy. And I had a little bit more time that week. And so I was the sort of lead organizer of a demonstration in Philadelphia. I remember we painted a big cloth banner that said, "Stop bombing North Vietnam, prevent World War III." And we did it in collaboration with a Quaker group in Philadelphia. We and they were the co-sponsors.
And where did you demonstrate with this?
In Philadelphia, but I don't remember where in Philadelphia. Yeah. It must have been a march. It was a march because I remember we were walking along and trying to keep people on the sidewalk so the cops wouldn't arrest us and stuff like that.
No arrests for this one?
No, there were no arrests in that one.
Well, that's good. the one thing I can say that I have seen from speaking with you all is that you sort of helped lay or solidify a foundation of protest, arrest, bail, repeat. And, this work, people repeat this to this day, whether you're a politician or whether you are a student group or an environmental group, this is people prepare for this. So that's at least one way that you can definitely see the importance, the influence of y'all's work. It's there. So let me ask you a little more about the reactions of those around you. You say you guys didn't know really what was going on, or you thought you knew how to solve this problem, but you really knew nothing. And of course, you may not have been conscious of what you knew, but you turned out to know things. So I wonder, given your academic environment, did you have any faculty, any ministers, anyone who you know, gave you all support or backing or encouragement for what you were doing? Or were you, you know, considered rabble rousers there as well?
No, I think the fact the campus was most, if I remember it right, the campus was mostly on our side. They maybe thought we were being foolish to, you know, get that deeply involved in it, and most, you know, should stick to our books, but they weren't opposed to the positions.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was a Haverford professor who bailed us out of this giant warehouse, which was in Media, Pennsylvania, I remember. Yeah. He put his house up, I think, you know, as a bail. It's wow. What I eventually heard, anyway. I never met him. I don't know his name. It's weird. I don't think I ever knew him, his name. Maybe I did. It's possible that I've just forgotten it.
Well, you really bring to mind a question that I have asked a number of people in this thought of support. Since sometimes support for you all may have been completely hidden, but was very vibrant, I wonder if you know of any other folks that may have made support efforts like this for you, either bailing you out or keeping the natives in the areas at bay from attacking you or anything of that nature?
You mean physically attacking us?
Oh, yes.
I don't remember ever feeling threatened. Things were a lot rougher in the South, right? This was Pennsylvania. And even the one time that I went to Maryland, there were people yelling, but there was not a physical threat. It was not like being in the South. And the anti-war movement also at that time, nobody was getting hurt. That happened later. So no, I don't remember any of that. No.
Well, I guess you were early and
yeah,
that's good.
No, I mean, we knew that there were people getting hurt in the South.
Oh, yes.
Oh, absolutely. And people were getting killed in the South, but not where we were.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be speaking with some folks that made that ride and did Freedom Summer and find out from them, you know, how they were feeling about that.
Yeah. Well, do you have Mimi Feingold on your
list? I do. I'm trying to get Mimi Feingold. I have folks out trying to see if she can speak with us. She has spoken so many times. She may be.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. She's everywhere and she's well documented. Her work is well. So, but we still want to know, from the angle of you all as groups of students, and what did you do with each other while you were on Swarthmore campus? Did you powwow? Did you talk about, you know, any fears or anxieties or motivations or things you wanted to run off and do? Did you talk about and know about what other groups of students may be doing, like say in Tennessee or what have you? Did you talk about that?
We certainly must have, but I don't remember those conversations. And certainly nothing about Tennessee. I saw that in your questions. Are you thinking of the lunch counter movement?
There were quite a few activities going on in Tennessee. Quite a few marches, yes, the lunchtime, and a lot of the more formal nonviolent resistance training. Have been directed towards those in Tennessee because they seem to, and in some cases North Carolina, because they seem to really need and be experiencing physical attacks, or definitely the possibility of that.
Yeah.
No, that's not to say you weren't attacked in Chester or in Cambridge, but.
Yeah. No, I don't remember anything about Tennessee at all. The only thing I remember worrying about was that if I got an arrest record, that might be a problem for getting jobs later on.
What did your parents say when you got arrested?
Well, they were worried about that. There wasn't any question of which side they were on, but they would have preferred that I not get arrested.
What was your college major?
Sorry, oh, psychology.
Wonderful, interesting.
Yeah, it didn't turn out to be as interesting as I hoped.
Mine didn't either. That was my undergraduate major.
Oh, is that right? Psychology.
That's not where I ended up, but that's where I started.
But where did you end up?
As an English professor.
As an English professor.
Yes, it's been a great deal of fun. It's been wonderful, even though, you know, the quote unquote demise of education wasn't fun, but teaching students over 30 years.
Uh-huh. And I wound up as a journalist, so that's not all that far.
Did you do any journalism work while you were on campus?
I did, actually, and I should have paid more attention to it. I started writing for the Phoenix, and I wrote quite a bit for the Phoenix. I didn't start as a freshman. I think I was a junior or a senior by the time I was writing. And so I was writing feature stories and having a wonderful time doing it. And why didn't I think maybe this is what you want to do, you know? But at the time, so the war was on and I was not a pacifist and I did not want to go to Vietnam and didn't particularly want to move to Canada. And so I decided I should stay in grad school as long as possible. Mm-hmm. So that ruled out journalism school, which was only a 1-year program, which is really kind of a pity. I should have done that. Coming from Swarthmore, I could have gotten into Columbia Journalism School. That would have been good. But at any rate, I worked for the, I wrote for the Phoenix and had a wonderful time doing it. But I don't remember I think I wrote some political pieces about the war. I've written a humor piece. I feel like I wrote a humor piece, but I can't remember. I don't have those. I don't think I have any of my clippings.
There are many articles from this period preserved from the Phoenix and online in the Civil Rights 1960 to 66 section. So there could very well be some of your pieces there. There are many. And I spoke to one of the editors of the Phoenix already. So I know there was a strain of you all who were mostly in charge of the journalism and continued that effort. Oh yes, Mr. Gelber, I spoke to him.
Dave Gelber, yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I know that many of you all continued in that strain and it made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. So tell us why you think the journalism bug didn't bite you like it bit everyone else.
Well, it did eventually, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I mean, a piece of it was that I needed to stay in graduate school.
Well, I agree. You're one of the first persons that I have run into who A, wasn't a pacifist, B, wasn't going to Canada, and C, wasn't going to the war either. So that's a brilliant statement to have made, and I'm very glad to have included it in this content. You'd be surprised. Your story is quite marvelous indeed. And I just would love for you to talk more about these memories you swear you don't have, but then you have them, and then they're marvelous. So can you tell me anything else that is popping to mind?
That's worth more.
About any of it. Your experiences getting arrested, your experiences protesting, your experiences leading, your experiences pretending as though you're not a leader. any of those things. If you can think of any pathways where you all's focus on civil rights was, you know, clearly dragged off to the Vietnam War now, other than the fact that they're coming to get us, what are we going to do? Tell us more about that.
What do you mean they're coming to get us? What are we going to do?
The draft.
Oh. Yeah, I don't think that. I don't think that for us, the threat of being drafted was a factor in our getting involved. We were against the war because we were against American imperialism. And just because of the horrible things that, you know, the American army was doing, just, right? That was on television all the time. I don't think it was because, you know, if we fought against the war, maybe we wouldn't have to go. It was certainly not a factor for me. I don't think it was a factor for anybody that I knew. Because on the contrary, we had an out. We could stay in school. So yeah, no, I don't think that was a motivation. It was because the war was horrible.
Yes, it was. And I have told people that I was born in November 63 and Kennedy was killed 17 days after I was born. And, you know, I came from a political family and was sat in front of the TV about, and I'm the TV generation. So I was sat in front of the TV about age 3 and I watched the whole Vietnam War on TV, the whole civil rights movement, the whole Black Panther movement, every assassination as though that is the sky above me, so to speak. It is a serious backdrop. And so in having experienced all that very, very, very chaotic period with various leaders rising and being attacked and trying to move through, et cetera. It's interesting to me to know, to understand more of how your students in the movement stayed in it for as long as you did. And given the chaos around you, what were you feeling about that chaos? Whether it seemed to be touching you, didn't particularly matter because you wouldn't have been in this movement in the first place if that part mattered. So how was all the chaos around you and the kind of vying of different groups making you feel in this process?
Well, so we did feel, I think, deep down that we were going to get someplace. That the world was going to become a better place, you know? I think most of the country did. I mean, it was that was a much broader feeling than just on the left, right? The sort of the liberal half of the country, John Kennedy and all of that. We were way to the left of John Kennedy, but that sense that we were living in an age of enlightenment, sort of, where things were going to get better. I think we believed that very deeply. I don't think we talked about it so much because it was assumed, I think. Mm-hmm. We knew that that was happening. You know, that's a huge difference between then and today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, here I am 50 years later, more than 55. Yeah, 55 years later, and I do not have the sense that the world is going to get better.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Well, seems like some things have gotten a whole lot better since then. The position of women is probably most. Gay rights, those kinds of, that has happened. Maybe Black people in the South are probably better off. I don't know that Black people in the North are. the level of economic inequality in this country today is way worse than it was back when I was in college. You know? I mean, that's huge. Yeah, I don't think that Black people in the, well, how much do I know? But because the level of inequality in the country has become so much worse, the position of Black people, if you're on the, still on the bottom, most, of course, not everybody, but a very disproportionate number of Black people are in the bottom part of the economy. And since the bottom part of the economy has dropped so far, that means they've dropped so far.
Agreed. Do you read the writing of Charles Blow in the New York Times?
Sure. Yeah, not always, but I do, yeah.
You know, he has the position that Black people should move back to the South because A, that's where the largest concentration of Black people live in the U.S., and B, that's where they have a bit more economic opportunity and the disparities of the North remain really bad compared to with other groups. So yeah. I certainly see that as a problem. I am sorry to watch this circle we seem to have been on in 50 years. And it makes me horrified to think, well, okay, well, what happened that went wrong that brought us back to this spot? Because yeah. Now we're having to, right where you all were trying to get people to vote. That's where we are, except now it's not the registration that's the problem. It's getting the vote through that's the problem. So
yeah,
what do you think about that circle? Well,
and then and then the whole Trump phenomenon is very scary that people... You know, there kept being things would happen that I thought, okay, this is going to do it. I thought the concentration camps and separating families was good. People would say, nah, that I'm not going that far. But nope, didn't hurt them at all. That a ridiculous figure like that should be competitive? I would not have guessed. I would never have guessed that. And it's very frightening because, you know, we could wind up in a war, although it's curious that Trump has not been nearly as eager to go to war as liberal Democrats have.
Hmm. Well,
but that doesn't mean he won't, because it seems crazy.
I hope we don't, but we have watched ourselves do some of the most ridiculous things that you could imagine for this country's history. We watched ourselves do that over the last 4 or 5 years. And if that wasn't bad enough, for God's sake, now we have a war in Ukraine that is really dragging your nose through the horrors that you have done in history. And so let's not do that. I really hope that we can find that spot where we can see what history was and what it allowed us to think about and how we should probably go in a different direction. Let's hope.
Yeah.
Do you recall ever being considered, and you may be kind of young in the process to have gotten this moniker, but were you ever considered an outside agitator, or were you with those who were considered outside agitators?
Oh, in Chester, absolutely. Oh, sure, absolutely, in Chester. We were all outside. We really were outside agitators.
Why? Because you're not from there?
Yeah. Well, we were certainly not from Chester. Right?
But you were agitating for freedom and civil rights. Yeah. So do you think that might be more than just the geographic location? How dare you white people come over here and disturb these Black people who sort of doing what we wanted them to do with no problem?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, they thought we were the reason that they were having problems, right? Of course, that's not, you know, right? The Black people of Chester were no idiots, and they were not going to do what, you know, mostly rich kids from it's worth what we're telling them to do.
Yeah, but you aren't actually, well, a question I have here that I'm interested in is from the students and conversations you've had, how many of you do you think were really married to this idea that white student intellectualism was gonna help save the social situations that we're in, that was gonna help push a more socialist agenda of equality, as opposed to what other groups might do, what CORE might do, what STEC might do, you know?
I don't remember us thinking that we were just trying to help SNCC and CORE. I don't remember thinking that we were going to, you know, supply some kind of, you know, brain power or ideology to people who would not otherwise have had it. I don't think so, no.
Do you think others assigned that idea to you for any particular reason, whether you students, your white students, your Swarthmore students?
Sure. Whenever anybody on the bottom tries to stand up, the people on the top always say, "Oh, he didn't really want to do that. Somebody must have made him do it." Right? Mm. It's much more comfortable to think that it wasn't that person's idea. Really, that person was perfectly satisfied with the way things were, saw the justice of the way things were, must be some outsider who's doing it. But we were certainly outsiders, and we were certainly agitating, but I don't think that we were, and I don't think we saw us. So we must have seen ourselves as trying to think in Chester. So we were trying to help people form community organizations. That was not something that necessarily would have been in their minds first, but the changes that they wanted to see in society were not something that we imagined we were showing them, oh, this is what needs to change. They certainly knew what needed to change.
You felt like you were just sharing some tools with them that could help them. Yeah. And for the most part, they felt that's what you were offering.
I don't know what they felt. They would have to speak for themselves. It would be interesting to hear what they thought of us. I'm not sure I ever knew.
Okay.
You know, people are very polite, of course. And we were there with them. We were getting arrested with them and all of that. Penalties for us were probably, we weren't missing days of work, but I don't know.
You were missing some school.
You could always, I don't know if my grades suffered. They may have. It certainly took a lot of time. I mean, the week that I was in media, I wasn't studying. But college is not as hard as it's made out to be. Even Swarthmore is not as hard as it's made out to be. There's a lot of free time.
Well, the last thing that I would like to ask you a little more of your perspective about is how you feel at this stage in your personal history and American history. How do you feel looking back on what you and your friends tried to do, given the awful issues we have now, whether it be, you know, mass incarceration or constant attacks against particular racial and ethnic groups, the crazy border situation where one governor can shut down half the country's food for a week or so. How does all that make you feel where you've been?
Yeah, well, it's certainly very depressing. And mass incarceration is another thing that's happened mostly since that time, right? It's gotten way, way worse than it was then. I don't regret any of it. I'm pretty depressed about the fact that also because my parents were communists, and I sort of, at the time, I thought the Soviet Union was going to become, you know, a model for the country, for the world, even though it, you know, I sort of understood that it wasn't yet, but it was, it turned out to be a complete loss, right? So all, and, you know, I didn't think about that a whole lot. I was mostly thinking about the United States, but it was part of my sort of the frame in which I saw the world, right? And that certainly collapsed. So now I don't, yeah, I'm not very hopeful. It doesn't mean that I don't think it's worth worth trying. I mean, I'm you know, I'm retired now, but I have full-time activist in Boston school politics.
Yes, I saw.
So, and I think I'm doing a better job now than I ever did, because I do know people in Boston and I do know what they think and what their real situations are. And, but they're not getting very far either.
Interestingly enough, that is a very recalcitrant intellectual city. Yep. It's got brains that spill across the country, but it's not going to change its ways very well.
Yep.
Very yep. quickly, not very much.
Yep.
I consider it one of the most brutal places that you can go to school. And it turns out, consistently turns out, genius people. Because, you know, you got to be really tough to make it through. Really, really tough. So I hope things will change and it will improve. I hope that as one of the locations in the U.S. that has maintained a lot of its strong education standards, they have not waned there as they have in some other places that started out, you know, to be really high up in that level. I hope it maintains, you know, the quote unquote education shining beacon on the hill. Please be. But, you know, I appreciate your continued work in education and for human rights, we'll call them now. And I'll cross my fingers with you that we don't blow off both our feet.
Yeah.
And I thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Have you talked to Walt Popper?
No, but I would love to. Would you like to ask him to talk to me?
Sure. I will do that. He was Dan and he, my roommate.
Yes, I would love.
Very involved in this stuff. And he went to Cambridge, I think, a lot more than I did.
Okay. Please.
And I think he has a better memory than I have.
So your memory is fine. And your memory is fine. And I thank you for it, because I heard things today that I've never heard before. So your memory is fine.
Well, good.
I appreciate it. And I'm going to send you the next step for our content here. We're collecting, and I'm hoping to speak to another 14, 16 people, as many of you as I can find, so that we have as full a view of this history as we could possibly get. And I'm gonna send you also in that, thank you, the link to the current content. So if you have not reviewed it, you can take a look at what's there. You might find your articles.
Maybe.
Well, thank you again. And you have a marvelous afternoon.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye now.
Nice to be here.
Bye.